Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me? Yeah? Good. I want to start by thanking Karsten and the organizers for putting this together. What an amazing event. This is very exciting. I'm really looking forward to this, and it's just really a great pleasure. So thank you, and thank you for inviting me. So I'm at the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon in Eugene. So we're interested in neuroplasticity, how plastic or changeable the brain is with different kinds of experience. And to do that, we study children and adults using a variety of different methodologies. The two that I'm going to talk about today, one is event-related potentials. And in addition to providing really cute pictures when you're giving a talk, ERPs are a very powerful method for studying online brain processing, especially the timing. Things happen very fast in the brain, and we're measuring the brain's electrical response every 4 milliseconds with this technique. And so we can get very good information about when in the brain something is happening. Less so with regard to where in the brain. And we have a complementary technique that we use for that that you've probably heard of, functional MRI. And so that complements ERPs in that it gives us more spatial resolution. So where in the brain is something happening. But it's a very slow, sluggish response on the order of 5 milliseconds, which is an eternity, 5 seconds, sorry, which is an eternity in brain time. So they complement each other, and we're interested in also investigating ways to integrate these two methods, and I'll just give you a flavor of that in this talk as well. So a long history of research using ERPs to study language processing has identified components, that is, the neural response to different types of violations in language, and has shown that non-identical brain systems underlie different subsystems of language. I'm going to primarily be focusing on syntax, but just briefly, and just for a bit of background, ERPs use a violation technique. So the idea is that we're studying a system or subsystem by perturbing that system, comparing the brain's response to the same word when it renders some type of violation compared to when it doesn't. And what we typically see when we do that is a difference in the brain's response. And then these topographical maps, as I said, ERPs don't provide really excellent spatial resolution, but they do give you some idea of the distribution of these effects. And so what these topo maps are doing is just mapping the difference in the response within a certain time window across the brain. Okay? And so the typical response associated with semantic violations is called the N400. Maximal about 400 milliseconds, a little bit short of half a second. And there's a different response that's associated with syntactic processing. And that's actually a biphasic response in which there's this early response, as early as a tenth of a second, your brain knows when you've heard some sort of a syntactic violation. So there's this early response. It's hypothesized to be, to some degree, automatic. And then that's typically followed by a later response called a P600, that's maximal more over the posterior parts of the brain, happens later. It's hypothesized to index more controlled processing. The idea might be that you're recovering, rescuing meaning or repairing the violation that you've just encountered. And so the first study I'm going to tell you about came from an observation that I made when I started looking into the literature on this. I was very excited, coming from a background in linguistics, to discover this, and it was very exciting, and started reading these papers and saying, this is how the brain is organized for syntactic processing, but who do they study? Who does about more than 90% of studies in psychology and cognitive neuroscience? Who are the participants? College students, right? So in light of the literature I'll talk about later and my own observations, I was curious as to whether things might look different if we went beyond the university community. So that's what we did in this first study. We went and recruited young adults with a wide variety of backgrounds, and we were interested in looking at proficiency differences. So we gave them standardized measures of English proficiency and broke them into two groups, one group basically scoring in the upper quartile and one group scoring in the lower quartile. And then we conducted an ERP experiment. In this particular experiment and the ones that follow with late learners, we used auditory phrase structure violations, so natural speech. We also wanted to make this paradigm difficult. It's difficult to approach ecological validity in the lab, but we wanted to try to make it as difficult as possible. So we included Jabberwocky sentences, different types of filler violations, We had variability in terms of sentence length and the violation point, and we used multiple tasks. So we wanted to make it as difficult as possible. So what we found when we looked at the high proficiency, again, native speaking monolinguals, is the typical pattern. These are over left anterior sites, and as you can see, there's this early 100 millisecond onset focalized response to syntactic violations. But when we compared this with the lower proficiency monolinguals, it looked a lot different. So they still have this early response at 100 milliseconds, a tenth of a second, but it looks a little bit different in that it's more broadly distributed both spatially and temporally. And that's consistent with actually a less mature pattern for brain organization. And we saw this both in the early response as well as in this later P600 response. And so the take-home point here was that neural organization for syntactic processing looked different as a function of proficiency. And we interpreted this pattern as probably reflecting a more efficient processing system. This enabled us to then go on and ask some questions about late second language acquisition. Many studies of late second language acquisition have the confound of proficiency, in that late learners are typically of lower proficiency compared to monolinguals. And so we used this lower proficiency monolingual group, and that's the same group that you see here. So native speakers who scored lower on these tests of proficiency. And we went out and we recruited some native speakers of German who started learning English at or around age 11. And we gave them all of the same measures, the same ERP paradigm, to ask the question, are they recruiting the same neural mechanisms to achieve a similar level of proficiency? And what we found was, in this experimental paradigm, they weren't. So this early anterior negativity, this early response at a tenth of a second, was absent in proficiency-matched late learners. Though they did show, and I don't have a slide for it, unfortunately, they did show a robust P600 effect, suggesting that they're using different neural mechanisms to achieve a similar level of proficiency. That was how we interpreted that. We also, for a subset of these participants, we ran them in fMRI using the same experimental paradigm with the idea that we might be able to use these proficiency and age of acquisition modulations to integrate the two methodologies, to get some interplay between them. And so this is just one example of how we did that. When we looked at the brain response in fMRI to the same syntactic violations in these native speakers, they show activation, and this is a fairly typical pattern, in left inferior frontal areas, Broca's area, and also activation in posterior areas as well. But the key point here that I have circled is activation in left frontal areas. And remember, they also showed this early anterior negativity effect. By contrast, the non-native speakers did not show activation in these left frontal areas. And so that's one example, and it's consistent with other evidence and other approaches that we've taken of trying to integrate these two methodologies. So it suggests that left inferior frontal areas might be at least in part responsible for generating that response that we're seeing in the ERPs. Whereas they did show, they actually showed more robust activation, the non-native speakers, in posterior parietal temporal areas, sort of back here, that we hypothesize have more to do with generating these more controlled effects, more controlled response that we see in the P600. Now to shift gears just a bit, as I said, we're very interested in the effects of experience on brain development, and to do that we want to do our best to quantify the different experiences that children and adults are having with regard to environment. The way that we do that is by assessing socioeconomic status. So statistically speaking, your parents' education level and occupation level are predictive of a whole host of outcomes into adulthood, including language, literacy, numeracy, health, and longevity. This is an illustrative graph, by the way. I have plenty of data to back this up. Two important points. The steepness of the gradient matters in a couple of important ways. So first of all, the difference between, in a given society, this is true at the country level, the state level within the U.S., even at neighborhood levels in some studies, the steepness, the difference between higher and lower socioeconomic status predicts the steepness of the gradient in outcomes, the larger the difference in outcomes in these things. And it also, as you can see, societies with less of a gradient do better overall. So the point here is that inequality matters. Now, of course, we realize and recognize that SES is just a proxy variable. It's a whole host. It's a very complex phenomenon, right? And there are a whole host of different aspects of the environment in which families differ. Most relevant to language, those include parental language use, the amount of time parents spend sharing books with their children, things like that. You'll see that I have stress highlighted. A lot of emerging work is suggesting that this is one of the primary mechanisms underlying some of these effects and some of what I'll talk about. Basically, exposure to chronic exposure to stress, especially early in development, is literally toxic for the developing brain. So the same parts of the brain that are really important for regulating the stress response are also the same parts of the brain that are really important for learning and memory and emotional regulation. So we're trying to dig deeper into that, but that's why I have that highlighted there. So there's a lot of evidence with regard to the relationship between socioeconomic status, cognitive skills, and emerging also brain organization. One of the most prevalent relationships with regard to SES and cognitive skills is with language. This is just one example. There is a lot of work from Hoff and Huttenlocher and Hart and Risley, et cetera. This is from Martha Farah's lab showing the relationship between language and socioeconomic status in first graders. And other relationships include cognitive control, working memory, selective attention. But again, here we're focusing on language. So emerging work has also shown, starting to show relationships between socioeconomic status and both brain function, and this is brain function in five-year-olds in a rhyming task in this left inferior area, again, Broca's area roughly, and also brain structure for areas of the brain important for language related to socioeconomic status. In our work, in this study I described earlier about proficiency, we also asked about SES and found that socioeconomic status, that is childhood socioeconomic status, the participants' parents' education and occupation level predicted their scores on these tests of English proficiency in adulthood. Furthermore, we found a relationship between socioeconomic status and this early brain response for grammatical processing. A tenth of a second, the mean amplitude, the difference in this brain response at a tenth of a second correlated with socioeconomic status, childhood socioeconomic status, even statistically controlling for proficiency, working memory, and adult educational attainment. So suggesting that some of the effects that have been documented with regard to socioeconomic status in development might endure into adulthood. So this is the cartoon part of the talk. So we're interested in studying these effects in development as well. Another powerful aspect of the ERP method is that it's very good for studying these things in children. Okay? If one of you guys was in one of my studies, I'd be asking you to make grammatical judgments with a video game controller about these weird sentences. And it's not your favorite thing to do, but I'm a nice guy, I'm paying you money, so you'd probably do it, right? It's much more difficult to get a four-year-old to do something like that. So one powerful aspect of this technique is that we can get a lot of valuable information about how children's brains are working while they're not doing an overt task. It is sensitive to things like eye movements and muscle movements, so we also need to be clever. We need to have a paradigm that is very engaging to try to minimize these movements and, of course, to keep the children's attention. So this is what we came up with. You've probably seen Pingu before. If you haven't, you should. It's really clever on YouTube. This is a different version than you've seen before. We got permission to modify it for our purposes, and so this is how we study language processing using ERPs in children and adults, by the way. Oh, whoops. Where is it?
Faye is jumping up and down on the bed. They jump off their beds and onto the floor. Mina and Urem Roding clip Rang and Bila on those their hooped. Minga and Ramfu Tepwix for this their keemfulp. The kids are going to have fun. They is not crying anymore. Pinga turns on the radio and this their house. Pinga turns up the penguin really loud. king who throws wood into that black stove. The concert are starting. Pundi nymphs maw on the flacture in their heath. Pingu throws the pancake in the air and drops it in the pan. Pinga claps her ball happily. Pinga clap to cheer Pingu on. Pindus and Lou do ram into that dingroskeeth. Trow clip rang la bee onto his heeg. Pinga jump up and down. Pen betros say a jimlay ramfu on his footh. The pancake is sticking to the roof. The pancake falls onto there his head. Pingu has an elephant's nose on this his face.
So, this has been happily very successful with regard to getting children to be engaged and enjoy it. We sometimes, even often, have four-year-olds asking to watch more Pingu, which is like having a four-year-old ask you to, can I give you more data? Hell yeah. So it's been very successful in that regard, and it's also allowed us to start looking at some of these effects with regard to socioeconomic status and language development. So again, it's a violation paradigm. You probably heard some of those violations. By the way, the penguin talk is coded to look at speech segmentation. I don't have time to get into it, but there's a reason for all of that penguin talk. And also, well, yeah, there's a reason for that. And so we're looking, again, here at the brain's response to these grammatical violations, okay? So first of all, it's important to validate the paradigm. So in a group of adults, adults love Pingu as well, by the way, wouldn't you? we see the expected brain response, okay? And that is the N400 response to these semantic violations that you might have heard, and this biphasic response to grammatical or syntactic violations. So we validated the paradigm with adults, and then we looked at socioeconomic status, the effects of socioeconomic status within our sample. We work a lot with children from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds, so our sample's actually skewed towards the lower end, and even despite of that, we still see, it's weak but significant, a correlation between behavioral measures of receptive language and socioeconomic status in 3 to 5 year olds. And so we then divided a group of 3 to 5 year olds into two groups, higher and lower socioeconomic status, matching for language proficiency in this particular study. I should note, by the way, that these manuscripts are in preparation. This hasn't been published yet. Okay. And so here's what we found. What we're seeing is what we're interpreting as a developmental precursor to this early anterior negativity effect. It happens later in 3, 4, and 5 year olds, so between 1,000 and 1,500 milliseconds. But in children from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds, you can see this distribution is consistent with, and there are other reasons we're interpreting it this way as well, consistent with this early effect. But when we look at children from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds, the picture looks much different. And again, it's much weaker and it's more bilateral. We're still working on the interpretation of that, but the point is that we're starting to see some of these differences even in this sample of young children. Interestingly, again, weaker but statistically significant, we're also seeing this same correlation between this brain response to grammatical violations and socioeconomic status, even controlling for chronological age and language proficiency in these children. And finally, in with regard to the Pingu paradigm, dividing the sample of adults that we had into higher and lower socioeconomic status, I ran some of these participants from a wider background. We're starting to see similar patterns. These are small groups, and again, this isn't published yet, but it's just interesting that even in a different paradigm, we're starting to see this consistent pattern in both adults and children, such that adults from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds show this more focal early effect and a larger later effect, whereas adults from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds show a more widespread or bilateral effect. Now, hopefully, you're asking yourself a couple of questions right now. You're saying a couple of things to yourself. First of all, This is kind of a big problem potentially, right? We're talking about the effects of poverty on the brain. So is there anything we can do about it? And then secondly, scientifically, hopefully you're saying, you know, it's really important to document that stuff, and I think it's really interesting as well, but this is just correlational, right? These are just correlations. Oh, great. So, of course, correlation doesn't equal causation, right? And so what we've done in our lab is sort of take that next step in terms of studying neuroplasticity, and that is to look at the effects of changing the environment. And the way that we do that, the way that we've done that for about 9 years now, is a series of intervention or training studies with families from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds, in which we randomly assign them to different training groups, and happily we're seeing some pretty promising results. And so I'm just going to quickly describe for you results from a paper we just published a couple of months ago, in which we've shown that this intervention that we've developed seems to be particularly effective for addressing some of these issues. It's a family-based training program called Parents and Children Making Connections, Highlighting Attention, because it's really based also on a lot of literature on the neuroplasticity of selective attention, which is another thing that we're able to study with event-related potentials in these young children. And it involves weekly meetings for 8 weeks with parents, where we talk about evidence-based approaches to different aspects of parenting, especially with regard to reducing stress. We also talk a lot about ways to use language differently with their children and how they can change the ways that they're using language to foster better language development. And then at the same time, in the other room, the kids are on the brain train, and they're training their selective attention and self-regulation and emotional regulation. These little cuties are training their attention by really carefully observing a snail and really controlling their bodies and controlling their brains while they observe this snail. So I don't have time to go into the details. I'm really happy to talk about it. But we're seeing some really encouraging results with regard to, first of all, changes in the parents themselves. So we do a videotaped play dyad where we code parent language behavior. And one of the things that we're seeing is improvements in aspects of parent language behavior that foster positive language development. In this case, turn-taking. That's the amount of balanced turn-taking in a conversation with your child, giving the child more opportunity to speak. We also see reductions in self-reported stress in our parents. And as I mentioned earlier, we think this is one likely mechanism. We also see increases in behavioral measures of language in our intervention group above and beyond two comparison groups. And if I didn't say this, these are randomly assigned, by the way, and also in measures of nonverbal IQ. And then this, we have a measure of selective attention in very young children. That's a very powerful mechanism for That's a very powerful mechanism for school readiness, if you think about it. If you're able to really control your brain and your attention, it should have overlaps into various areas with regard to school readiness. And what we've documented before, consistent with other evidence, is that children from lower SES backgrounds don't show a modulation with attention at 100 milliseconds, at a tenth of a second. Speaking of attention, that we do see in a group of higher children from higher SES backgrounds. And happily, after our intervention, we're seeing positive changes in these children's brains. So they're developing an attention effect at 100 milliseconds, at a tenth of a second. And we have data, pre-post data, from the Pingu paradigm on this as well, and we're just a little behind in the analysis. I was hoping to be able to show you some, not quite there yet, but we'll be able to look at how our intervention affects brain mechanisms for language processing as well. Just a quick note about future directions. We have a lot of data that I wasn't able to talk about and that we're still analyzing thoroughly. Including fMRI data and data from a different method that allows us to look at connectivity between brain areas in adults who vary as a function of proficiency, socioeconomic status, and age of acquisition. And then we're always trying to We're continuing our studies to try to get at these questions with regard to environment and socioeconomic status. So we're continuing to look at children and adults from a wide range of SES backgrounds, and we gather a lot of demographic and questionnaire data, parent language behavior data, as I've mentioned, behavioral measures. I haven't had time to talk about it, but we get DNA, genetic effects as well, though environment, genes are not destiny, environment trumps genetics. We're also going to get a measure of stress physiology as well, and all of these things with attention and language processing. So we think evidence is important, so I just want to point out this is all free online. We made a video program for anybody who cares about children that discusses the evidence for the effects of experience on brain development, changingbrains.org. It's all free, available soon in Espanol. And I just want to point out that I'm lucky enough to get here to get to come to this beautiful city and tell you about this work, but it's a wonderful team of folks that we have who are working on this, including there's Helen, the director of the lab, and then I want to especially thank my colleagues Yoshiko and Mandy, who are my partners in crime on the Pingu project. So thank you very much.
Hi, Eric.
Hey.
I noticed when you look at the correlation between SES and language scores, it's a significant correlation, but it's actually, when you're looking at it, it's not the strongest correlation, and
the
spread is really huge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you take all of those subjects and divide them into the high and low proficiency group, it's therefore kind of surprising that you see this sort of categorical distinction between having ELAN and not having ELAN. Based on the regression plots that you show there, the correlation plots. So it makes me wonder, maybe is the ELAN effect, you know, it could potentially then therefore maybe be carried by, say, the upper part of that high SES group, for example? You can't really tell from just looking
at it. You mean with regard to proficiency?
No. So you have a categorical ERP distinction, right, between high and low proficiency.
Right.
But that effect could be carried by a subset of the high proficiency high SES subjects. You can't really tell when you're dividing them into two groups like that. So I'm wondering if you did a regression analysis, if you could see a little bit more clearer picture that there's some kind of gradient increase in ELAN correlating with the SES.
Sure. No, I think that's a very good point. We did something similar to a regression approach, which is partial correlation, in which we looked at that relationship and controlled for proficiency, and that's correlation was still significant, but I think that's a really important point. Thanks.
You may have covered this, and I didn't catch it. You have behavioral data on the children as well as the neural data?
Yes.
So how do the behavioral data and the neural data fit together? So are the low SES children unable to tell when you've illegitimately got two determiners in a row, for
example?
Oh,
I see. So that's one potential drawback to this approach. So we don't have online behavioral data with the Pingu paradigm, precisely because we're not using an online task. So I actually can't answer that question. What I can say and what I tried to show is that it seems like, interestingly, to this point, we're still acquiring more data. It appears as though the relationship between SES and brain organization is stronger than that between proficiency and brain organization for language. And we're continuing to explore that. But, we don't have online measures of proficiency in the ERP task, unfortunately.
So what I'm thinking is, in children's everyday speech, regardless of their socioeconomic status, they've got the determiner system down. So children never say two determiners in a row when it's illegitimate.
Sure.
So they may or may not be able... So I'm wondering what you think the brain response is showing with respect to children's grammar or children's responses to grammatical violations. So how do those things differ?
Well, given that we've validated the paradigm with adults, and this is a well-used paradigm with adults, again, with the idea being that we're examining the system by perturbing the system. So these violations are doing what we expect them to do in that they're creating a perturbance that's reflected in a brain response. I mean, that's why we interpret the response that we're seeing to those as reflecting a brain response to grammar. Maybe I didn't answer your question well. But.
So definitely it's a brain response to grammatical violations. My question is really about how we should conceptualize the connection between the brain response to violations mm-hmm. and what speakers are able to do as a matter of course in language learning, whether they're high or low SES. So children don't make those errors, even though they may not be able, their brains may not be able to detect them in the paradigm that you're using. And I'm not casting any doubt on the paradigm you're using. I'm just saying children don't make those errors, regardless of SES.
Right, which is actually the point of using those errors.
Yet their brains don't recognize to the same extent as high SES children's brains do, that
right.
there are errors being made. So
right.
what I'm asking you to speculate about
sure.
is the difference in the abilities mm. that control children's speech and what seems to be an intact grammar, despite being low SES, and their the inability of their brains to recognize violations.
Sure. So if I'm understanding correctly, what we would hypothesize, based on some other data that I haven't shown you, and I'll also stress that we're still working on this, but what we'd hypothesize is that probably what we're seeing with regard to the difference in higher and lower SES is with regard to the maturation of these brain areas that are important for, say, grammatical processing. And so what the response pattern in the higher SES children might be reflective of is a response that's moving more quickly towards what we might think of as a more adult response, whereas the response in the children from lower SES background, and I should note that there is a response, it's just different, and it's more bilateral, for example, and generally speaking, a typical pattern in brain maturation is that you start with a sort of more widespread pattern, and with more experience and expertise, it becomes more focal. So I think what we would speculate at this point is that we're seeing differences in the maturation, maybe in the rate of maturation of these brain areas for grammatical processing. Does that make sense?
I'll talk to you more later.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
We're out of time for questions. Thanks.